This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Alison Bechtel's new graphic memoir, Are You My Mother?, will make you laugh, and it'll probably make you cry. It's about her complicated relationship with her mother, Helen, who was married to a closeted gay man and dreamed of being an artist. Bechtel had written about her dad in a previous graphic memoir, Funhouse, which was a popular and critical hit. In this new book, Alison Bechtel uses scenes from her adult life, memories and artifacts from her childhood, sessions with her therapists and the writings of Virginia Woolf, psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott, and Alice Miller, author of the drama of The Gifted Child, to shed light on her struggles to understand her family and to come to terms with herself. Let me say, it's a riveting read. Alison Bechtel is a cartoonist, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Are you relieved that it's over? Because I got the feeling that writing this book was difficult, to say the least.
It was a long slog. I am happy it's finally done. It took me about 6 years.
Wow.
Much of that just struggling with the writing. And I did the drawing actually pretty quickly, maybe in the last year or so.
Well, what's interesting about this book is it operates on so many different levels, is that it is also about writing. I mean, it's about your life, it's about your family, it's about your therapy, it's about some of these literary figures, but it's also about what it means to write something.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to boil it down to a, you know, short blurb, but I would say it's a book about writing, about becoming a writer.
And the process, the kind of angst that you have to go through, the self doubts, the questioning, all of that.
Yeah, and especially in connection with my mother. I feel like I previously wrote a memoir about my father. Mm-hmm. This one is about my mother. But in a way, both of the books to me are about the ways that my very creative parents simultaneously inhibited my own creative expression and encouraged it in a very vital, wonderful way.
Well, I have to say, reading your book, I was thinking about how children, including adult children, are forever trying to figure out their parents. If I get together with my siblings, we inevitably talk about our parents. I mean, it seems that that's what children do, which is to try to figure out, how did these two people come together and how did I come out of this?
Yeah. I think it's an eternal mystery. And as we go through life, if you're lucky, you get more and more little clues, like you learn stuff from your family, friends reveal information. No one ever presents you with like the whole story of your family. I feel like life is a quest of trying to solve that mystery.
And do you feel like your siblings had a different family life than you do, a different
child? Completely. Yeah. I mean, I think everyone in my family had a very different experience of our family. But yeah, my brothers, I know, don't quite see it the same way I did.
Even though, obviously, growing up in the same household.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't really matter. At one point in this book, I think you're talking to your therapist, where you say that in your family, and I'm quoting here, my family, boys were good and girls were bad. What does that mean?
Well, I just always had a sense that boys were somehow considered innocent and girls were more knowing, like girls knew more. I know, some kind of strange Adam and Eve fallout, perhaps.
Temptation? Knowledge?
Knowledge. I think it's more about knowledge. And at one point in my own therapy, my therapist said, I want you to do something. I want you to ask your mother, what was the main thing she learned from her mother? Don't tell her not to think about it, just ask her and say the first thing that comes to her head. And my mother said, she played along with this very gamely, she said, oh, boys are more important than girls. That's what she learned from her mother. You know, and that's the larger cultural reality of life in the 50s and 60s, that was just kind of a given. But it was hard, and part of what I'm trying to do in this book about my mother is look at what her circumstances were as a young woman coming of age in the 50s. What did that mean? What did that mean for her options and possibilities?
In fact, we see she's in a play. That's where she meets your father. I mean, she seemed like, and I should say she's still alive, so she seems like a person with deep creative impulses.
Absolutely. I feel kind of bad in some of the press that the book has gotten. She gets described as like a frustrated or thwarted artist. And I feel like my mother was quite heroic in the ways that she found ways to be creative, to do community theater, to she read voraciously, she studied the piano, while holding down a job and raising three children. Like, it was kind of superhuman.
As you said, it's not easy to write, but it seems to me it's maybe even harder to write a memoir, and maybe even harder than that to write a book about a parent who is still alive.
I know.
As you roll, you're holding your head and rolling your eyes. What were you thinking?
I thought writing about my father was hard, but he had been dead for 20 years by the time I started to tell that story. And not only was my mother going to read this book about her, but our relationship was evolving throughout the time I wrote the book, which made the writing process very tricky for me.
In fact, at one point in this book, you say, "I don't want to hurt you." This is to your mother, but I have to do this. I mean, you felt like you had to write this book, or you had to create this book.
Yes. And the amazing thing about my mother, part of why I think she is such a fascinating character, is that she is not happy that I'm revealing family information. She does not like having information about her life exposed. But she is able to somehow hold that or allow that to happen because she respects the creative impulse.
It's a this kind weird, of a mixed message.
It's a very mixed sort of schizoid thing, but we keep navigating it.
And not to be too overtly psychological here, but since you wrote your first book about your father, now your mother, I mean, is it to fix your family, do you think? Or is it to help you understand all the things that you grew up with, who you came from, how you ended up where you are?
I know that it's probably crazy and ridiculous to think that one can fix one's family, but I do think on some level that's what motivates me. I feel less clear. I certainly felt that when I was writing the book about my dad. Oh, I'm going to reveal this family secret that no one has ever really talked about, and that's going to bring us together. We're going to, you know, become more intact. And that totally didn't happen.
Right.
Or, you know, maybe it's just happening in on a much slower time frame than I originally envisioned.
And the secret about your dad was that he was gay. Right?
Or bisexual.
Or bisexual.
And also that we're pretty sure that he killed himself, but that was also clear. I mean, not clear because he was hit by a truck and it was... Right. You don't talk about suicide. It's another forbidden topic, and that felt risky to reveal, but also important to reveal.
But from your perspective, if you believe or it feels like he committed suicide.
Yes.
Your book actually begins with you driving your car. You're driving and you're thinking about how to talk to your mother about writing this book, and then in a sense, you look up and there's a bread truck, right?
Yeah, the Stroman Sunbeam bread truck.
There's the bread truck that killed your dad.
Well, it wasn't the exact truck, but this truck did swerve out in front of me in this weird, jarring way.
This really like did happen?
Yeah, it really did happen. It felt like a sign, a literal sign.
Well, and each of these chapters begins with a dream that you have, and then you begin to explore the story. Are you a vivid dreamer, a good dreamer, someone that remembers their dreams?
Well, I had a period of early in the process of writing the book about my father when I had these really powerful dreams. I wouldn't say typically I have amazing dreams, and I know you're not supposed to write about your dreams in books. That's like the lesson number one.
Oh, I did not know that.
But I tried to keep them short, and I tried to keep them really pertinent to the psychic issues I was talking about. But I did have this amazing period of fertile dreams in about 2002 when I was writing about my dad. And those form the sort of narrative backbone of this book about my mother.
And you think those dreams came from just the kind of thinking that you must have been doing, or the memories that might have been dislodged, or
I think that they came out of my anxiety of telling of. They all happened around the period when I was telling my mother I was going to write about my father. And then when I started to show her, I was getting ready to show her my early drafts of the piece, and then dealing with her, you know, sending that to her, waiting for her response, dealing with her response. It was all like within a 2-month period. And the dreams felt very much about, I don't know, kind of this psychic battle in which I was taking on my mother in a significant way that freed me up from something, freed me up from some inhibiting force.
I was thinking about this, the notion of trying to fix a family, and it seems to me, I think that's, I don't know if that's universal, but it's something that I can personally relate to. I mean, that impulse to try to either help parents or help oneself by thinking about, you know, what could I have done to have made life easier or better.
Well, I feel so sort of conflicted because I'm doing something that I think helps and heals and makes things better, but my mother doesn't necessarily agree. She, you know, her generation is very different about talking about personal issues. She believes that you keep this stuff to yourself and that there's something heroic about that. And my generation is the opposite. I came of age learning, oh, the personal is political. You've got to, like, talk about this. Get it out there. That's how change happens. That's how we share, you know, our experiences. We're not alone. We're not isolated. And maybe I've gone a little too far with that. I'm not sure.
You're sort of rethinking that or sort of wondering.
I am a little bit.
Well, you put your life out, right?
I know. What was I thinking?
It's too late for not that. What's your mom like, Helen?
My mother is wonderful. I don't have many friends who have as fun kind of connections with their mother as I do. Like, I really enjoy my mother's company. I mean, everyone loves their mother. Most people love their mother. I love my mother, but I also really, really like her.
Oh.
She's funny. She's very always thinking, busy, engaged, reading something. Always filled with conversational topics. She's amazing.
Yeah, but I also got, we're almost up in a break here, almost, but I also get the feeling that you're, I don't know if you're afraid of her.
Oh yeah, I'm terrified of her. I forgot
about that part. So you love her, you like her, and you're scared of her.
Yeah.
All sort of wrapped up together.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, because I have a feeling it's an important one. We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Alison Bechtel, and she has written a new graphic memoir. It's called Are You My Mother? A comic drama. And a couple of years ago, I guess 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, she wrote a book about her father called Funhouse, and that was subtitled A Family Tragicomic. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up our lines, our phone lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, A Tale of Madness and Murder, of Rebellion and Revenge. Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in opera in concert at the Kimmel Center. Richard Strauss's Elektra. Ava Johansson sings Elektra, a role for which she has received wide recognition. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. May 10th and 12th at the Kimmel Center, Charles Dutoit conducts Richard Strauss's Elektra.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with a message you have heard throughout this spring membership campaign here at WHYY. If you listen to WHYY, and in this case Radio Times, take the next step and become a supporter. You know about the in-depth news, analysis, and interviews you hear when you listen, whether it's terrestrial or satellite radio, online, or as a podcast. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Is education your passion? Arcadia offers career advancement programs for working adults. Arcadia University's King of Prussia campus graduate education programs have evening and online options. Recognized for instruction in inclusive and special needs education, Arcadia is hosting a May 10th information session in King of Prussia. You can explore options including studies in instructional technology, applied behavioral analysis, autism, and more. To register, arcadia.edu/master of education. Arcadia supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Alison Bechdel's syndicated comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For, ran for something like 25 years. Her first graphic memoir, Fun Home, A Family Tragicomic, was a bestseller, also a critical hit, explored her troubled relationship with her father. Her new graphic memoir, Are You My Mother? Is about her complicated relationship with her other parent, her mother, and Alison Bechdel calls it a comic drama. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So you love your mother, you like your mother, and you are afraid of your mother. It's a very tumultuous combination of emotions.
Well, my mother is a forbidding, critical figure. I mean, she loves criticism as an art form. She's, you know, she reads reviews. She's a critical person, and that she's also critical, you know, on an everyday basis. Right. Like, she's a perfectionist. And it's kind of hard to ever get anything right. So as a writer, you know, I never really liked to show my mother my writing. Or on the, excuse me, the few times that I did as a young woman. So sorry.
It's okay.
I remember in my early 20s, I sent her a little sample of a memoir piece I had written. And she wrote back all over the page in red ink, really wonderful stylistic criticisms. But what I had really wanted was her personal response to what I had written. And there
she
was
couldn't
zero,
do that.
Nothing personal. So I feel like in a way that writing this whole book is just sort of an expanded version of that early piece. But still, my mother has not responded personally to the book.
Well, my understanding is that her response to this new book is, and I'm quoting here, well, it coheres, meaning what? Yeah. It's coherent.
Yeah. I was pretty psyched about that.
what do you make of that? What is she trying to tell you?
I think she felt like she needed to say something, and that was, you know, a formal comment and a positive one.
Yeah. So you took it positively. I mean, it feels...
Well, everything she says feels double-edged to me. Like, I guess I kind of worry, like, you know, it almost coheres, or you manage to sort of string this thing together. I'm not quite sure how to ever take anything she says.
You include in this book a part of your childhood where you were writing in a journal and, I guess, had trouble putting words down and would kind of get caught up, I guess, in the moment. And your mother actually became your transcriber.
Oh,
your,
yeah. This was like a really amazing thing that my mother did for me. I kept a journal as a kid. And at one point I had this weird spell of obsessive compulsive disorder. And just to make a simple journal entry took forever because I'd be crossing things out and making these blots on the page. And she noticed that I was having this weird thing going on. So she said, let me write in your journal for you. You'd give me dictation. I'll write down what you say. And for 6 weeks of my childhood, she did that. And I have the journal. It's really fascinating to see. We go from my crazy, blotted, childish writing to her tidy adult writing. But she's writing down my words. And, you know, my mother was very busy running this family, teaching, doing all the things she was doing. And I didn't ever get a lot of focused attention from her, but that period of time when she was writing in my journal was amazing.
Wow.
And I feel like something really got transmitted to me there, something about being a writer, something about keeping track of one's own life in the form of a diary. My mother also keeps a diary, has always done that. But also there was some kind of exchange that happened. All of my yearnings for love and connection and touch, the kind of things, you know, more functional families just express through physical affection or, you know, stuff like that, all of that got funneled through this act of writing. Mm-hmm. of my mother writing down my words. And so
it's pretty powerful.
Well, yeah, no, that's
in the context of your life, because you also say that at a young age, I think you're age 7 years old, your mother's, she stopped kissing you goodnight. She just sounds like she didn't, you know, tuck you into bed.
I feel pathetic whining about this at age 51. I know
understand.
That's a little ridiculous, but it was, you know.
I was shocked. I mean, I don't understand that.
Seven is pretty little.
It is pretty little.
I don't understand it either. And I was, you know, I think in a way I was kind of hoping she would have some response to this, but no.
To explain why.
I think she really, my mother treated my brothers pretty differently. She was quite affectionate and warm with them. But I feel like that was her message to me of, you have to survive. You have to make it. You have to be tough. Right. Like me. And I became tough.
Indeed, indeed. But also this notion that the boys are good and girls are bad. I mean, you could have.
Well, I think, you know, that doesn't serve anyone, you know.
No.
That didn't serve my brothers very well either. It was a unfortunate kind of dynamic.
One of the things, and I think therapy is so often mischaracterized and stereotyped and, you know, seen as just too much navel-gazing or shallow self-help. And I have to say, in this book, I think you write about and draw and depict really good therapy. And it seems like the therapist that you personally saw seemed like she was someone who could help you in that really profound way that a really good therapist can help somebody.
I was very fortunate when I was in my late 20s and first sought out a therapist to find someone who was amazing, who was very gifted. It is hard to find good therapists. I've tried to, you know, it took me a long time to find another person as good as that. But therapy, when it works, I think, is the opposite of navel-gazing. It's something that enables people to really attain autonomy in not just a personal sense, but in a political sense. It enables us to become citizens, to be effective people in the world.
Did it also help you as an artist, as a writer, cartoonist? I mean, as someone who's obviously thinks a lot about their life and has written a lot about your life.
Very much. I started my last round of therapy, like, I think 11 years ago now.
Yeah.
And it was when I was in the middle of trying to write this book about my father, the first memoir. And I was kind of paralyzed. It was very hard for me to write. It was very hard for me to even speak. Like, my therapist called my problem undoing. Whenever I said something to her, I would say, oh, I didn't really mean that. No, I don't know what I'm talking about. And that would happen in my writing process, too. Every sentence I put down, I would delete it.
Sort of like those childhood scribbles.
Yeah,
getting,
it was like
rid of stuff.
Reenacting that obliteration of my childhood diaries. And, I don't know, through my own work doing the writing and my work in therapy, which feel separate. I don't feel like my writing is the same kind of therapeutic process as what I do on the couch. They're separate and complementary. Mm-hmm. But through both of those processes, I feel like I've gotten more easy with expressing myself.
You also include, and this is how this book operates on several different levels, a pretty well-known psychoanalyst, Donald Winnicott. You include him as a character in a way. I mean, at one point, I think you want him to be your mother.
Yes.
I think they call that transference, right?
Yes. I became very fascinated with this guy, Donald Winnicott. I guess I first heard about him when I was reading a very popular book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, which I think a lot of people read when they start doing therapy. And they kept referring in that book to this guy, Winnicott.
Yeah.
And his ideas just sounded so appealing to me. There was something very maternal and nurturing about the way he described what happens in those very early days between the mother and the infant. And I knew I wanted to learn more about his stuff when I was embarking on this memoir about my mother, and I started first I read a biography of him, which was fascinating. His own life is such an amazing story. He didn't really like hit his stride until he was in his 50s. I find that fascinating. People who get, you know, aren't early bloomers, but really hit their stride late in life. He didn't even have sex until he was 48, which I find fascinating. Yeah.
Wow.
He was married for a long time, but in a celibate relationship. And then he met someone else during the war who he really fell in love with and ended up divorcing his first wife and marrying Claire, his second wife, who he had a wonderful creative collaboration with. And I just found that whole story so very compelling. And it was after he left the first difficult marriage and got together with Claire that his own writing and ideas started to really take off.
And he wrote about a number of things. As you say, it's about object relations theory, but being, you know, a good enough mother. I mean, it sounded like, again, this search to try to understand this mother-daughter relationship.
Yeah. Winnicott was a pediatrician, but he also started training as a psychoanalyst, and he was able to use a lot of his medical training. I don't know. He was just like this amazing guy who was kind of magical with children. He could meet kids and diagnose their problems and practically cure them on the spot of their strange neurotic, symptoms. But his big idea was the transitional object. That's the thing he's probably most famous for. And the way children use a blanket or a stuffed animal. I mean, that's a very familiar thing.
Sure.
We all know about that. Most people remember
their
transitional object. But Winnicott theorized that this object is a way that the child is gradually separating themselves out from the mother. And the thing about the mother, whether you're a boy or a girl, is that you're a part of this person.
Right.
You know, you're physically a part of this person. And as an infant, you aren't aware that you're separate. You don't think that you're separate from anything as a newborn. You're just like, everything is all one big connected thing. But gradually you learn that your mother is not part of you, that getting fed is not magical. Someone has to like show up and do that.
And that you can leave.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the whole trick, is it's the mother's job to enable the baby to separate.
Did you have a transitional object? Did you have a blankie or a teddy or something or other?
I do have a teddy bear. I still have it. I don't remember it from infancy. But I think I'm not quite sure when I got it. But
It feels like a transitional object.
Yes.
And did you name your cat Donald after Donald Winnicott?
I did.
Maybe that's your transitional object.
She's certainly very soft.
You mentioned this book by Alice Miller, The Drama of the Gifted Child. She also plays a role in your memoir. And there's a scene where you discover her book and you go to pay for it at the bookstore, and the woman behind the cashier or the cashier says to you, "Well, kiss life as you know it goodbye," after you read this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know this at the time, but apparently this is kind of a sacred text for a lot of people.
Did it work that way for you?
It did. It's a funny book. It was actually Alice Miller wrote this book for other psychoanalysts, and the gifted child that she talks about is the psychoanalyst.
Right.
Like almost all of her trainees, she writes in the book, almost all of her psychoanalytic trainees have the same background of a parent who somehow needed the child, usually an oldest child, to perform in a certain way that entailed suppressing some vital aspect of their self. And that made these children very attuned to other people's needs, and in particular the parents' need. And that makes them very good children, very helpful children. But it comes at a cost.
Because they're parentified in many ways.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I always had this weird sense that I was my my mother's mother somehow. Like it was my job to take care of my mother. I know she would think that's ridiculous, but as a child, that's really what I felt.
Yeah.
Like I had to take care of her.
You know, again, as I was reading your book and even talking to you now, and I'm thinking of other people who have described to me a fierce parent, you know, a parent that they, as you say, loved, liked, and were afraid of. And then, you know, as an outsider or a friend, you meet them, and they're 85 years old, and they couldn't be cuter.
I know.
And they're not this fierce, scary person that you believe your friend, you know, grew up with.
I know. Well, that's the weird thing about parents. They have this awesome power over us, even after we're adults. Yeah, I like meet my girlfriend's parent, and I know they have like some difficult dynamic, but to me, she's just like totally cool.
Yeah, exactly. You also include a game in here. I don't know how often you played this with your mother, the crippled child game.
Yeah, that's just a really vivid memory I have from childhood of this imaginary game I would play with my mom. It's kind of crazy, the crippled child game. I mean, really. But I had fallen arches as a kid, and so every once in a while I'd have to go to the hospital, to the orthopedic wing, to get my fallen arches looked at. But when I was there, I would see these other kids who had big braces on their legs and shoes and crutches, and there was something extremely fascinating to me about that. And there was this way that I envied those kids. And I think because there was a way that their wounds were being attended to, and my wounds were invisible. No one could see them. And I that care that they got was very touching to me. And so my mother would, I'd play this game, Mom, I'm going to be one of the crippled children. And she would play along with it in this amazing way. She'd say, oh, do you need some crutches? And even as like a three-year-old or four-year-old, I knew there was something very perverse about wanting to have a disability. But I felt such an amazing sense of freedom that my mother was going there with me. She was allowing me to have this fantasy. She was encouraging it, playing with it. And I feel like in that moment, she was teaching me to write.
Oh, because it's very, I mean, when you think about it, that's a pretty creative thing for a child to do. You needed something from your mother, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you made up this disability.
We were collaborating.
Right.
It was great.
And so she would give you an invisible crutch or an invisible bandage?
Something like that. I don't really remember the details. I just mostly remember this amazing feeling of imaginative freedom. Like your mind could take you anywhere.
And when you wrote journals as a kid, was it the sort of journals that little girls would write about what their day was like and their friends and what happened in school?
Yeah, they're very boring. But one thing I love about my childhood journals is I know they are absolutely true. Children have no reason to lie or deceive or mislead. And as a record, I find those childhood entries really interesting.
And you have them? They were saved?
Yeah, I saved them.
You knew to save them.
I don't know. I'm just kind of anal retentive, I guess.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also, get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And talking with Alison Bechtel today on Radio Times, she wrote a syndicated comic strip for about 25 years called Dykes to Watch Out For. Her first graphic memoir called Fun Home, a family tragic comic about her dad. And her new book, Are You My Mother? A Comic Drama. Stay with us. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Public broadcasting has an unusual and very successful business model that has thrived for decades. It's really very simple. We produce high-quality news and interview programs. You listen to them, and then you become a member. You do that by making a pledge of support by calling 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY. We offer so many new features on our website. You can pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks very much.
Throughout the ages, mankind has communicated through the heartbeat of a drum and the spirit of a voice. May 10th through 13th, The Painted Bride presents Skins and Songs. Spoken Hand Percussion Orchestra meets Philip Hamilton's Voices. This live music presentation highlights the strength and beauty of humanity when cultural diversity prevails. Two ensembles, 22 artists, and over 33 traditions merge together as one on stage. For tickets and info, paintedbride.org. The Painted Bride supports WHYY.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with cartoonist Alison Bechtel. And again, she's got a new memoir called Are You My Mother? A Comic Drama, she calls it. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Susan from Chestnut Hill. And this is Susan Gregory. And Susan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I had to tune in because with Alison Bechtel.
Well, indeed.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
What do you want to say, Susan?
Well, Alison, I am, first of all, just such a huge, huge fan of your work, and it's such a treat to get to hear you now.
Oh, thank you.
Talking about your new book. I was on Radio Times also talking about my memoir, In Spite of Everything. And it was a pretty full courts press open viewing of my own family life. And my father died also. And you know, I sort of wound my whole book around Miller's narcissistic wound idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which came to, you know, embody my entire gestalt. But, you know, aside from that, you know, one of the questions that I had for you, there's sort of two questions. A, I got not very much flack from my own family for the memoir and exposing all of these, you know, terrible secrets of theirs because I had given them, as you did, drafts in advance.
Uh-huh.
But I did get a lot of flack from people who knew nothing about my family.
Oh,
and there was a way in which they sort of, you know, felt that I had, you know, hoodwinked or, you know, really viciously exposed, you know, this, you know, unknowing, intimate group of mine.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was sort of interesting. And I'm wondering if you've gotten some of that at the same time, because you are an artist and you're creating a world that has at least the veil of fiction, if you feel that you've been somewhat protected by that. I mean, I guess in some ways, you know, reading your work, and it almost feels as if, you know, you're really creating this contained universe that, although we know that it's true, also feels like a world unto itself, whereas in a straight-up print memoir, there's almost sort of a more raw, lashing kind of effect. And I'm just wondering what you think.
Two great questions, Susan. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Alison a chance to weigh in. And I guess, interestingly, as Susan says, her family seemed to be more okay with her memoir than people who didn't know her.
I feel like it's more the opposite. I have not gotten a lot of flack from the general public. I hear secondhand stories from my mother about her friends' reactions, who are sort of defensive on her behalf. But so far, I've not had any, you know, strangers say, oh, you were unfair to your mother.
Or feeling somehow protective of your mother.
Yeah.
Or...
But I'm braced for that if it happens.
So far. And the notion that just words, that when you begin to add cartoons or illustrations or the sort of graphic part of this memoir, that it... it changes it? Do you think there's some truth in that?
Well, it was interesting that she called it a veil of fiction, the drawings, because I don't think of it that way. I feel like I'm trying very hard to draw real people, real places, real moments in time. But I do think there's something about the comics format that enables you to talk about difficult or painful things in a way that is not too unbearable or overwhelming for the reader. There's just something about juxtaposition of words and images that it's not necessarily humorous by any stretch. It's not always humorous, but there are things you can do with pictures that sort of add a third layer or a I don't know if it softens the story. I guess in a way it does. I guess that's sort of true.
Susan, thanks for calling into Radio Times. But I got the feeling that the pictures, the images, were a bigger struggle for you than the actual words. And do I have that right?
Well, I struggle over everything.
See, that's your fate in life?
No, I feel like I struggled more with the writing. The images are, I work hard at those, but they're not like scraping at the bottom of my soul in the same way that the writing is. Mm. The drawing is more of a craft, actually. You know, it's demanding and there's a lot of steps to it, but it's not emotionally so difficult.
I read somewhere that you, your feature obviously very much in your memoir, that your drawings of yourself are based on photos that you take of yourself. Is that true?
Yeah, I have this really insane work process where I take reference photos of myself as almost all the characters in the book, just because it began as a drawing aid. You know, just it's easy to draw a complicated pose if I'm looking at a photograph of it. But more and more, I'm putting on costumes. I'm holding props. Like, I've dressed up in a suit to be Donald Winnicott. I'm put on a dress to, you know, pose as my mother when she was in a play. I spend a lot of time staging these little scenarios.
Mm, it sounds like some kind of a theater production. I mean, that you're acting.
I am. I'm acting. And the really convoluted part is that many of the times I'm acting as myself. Right. I'm like myself in therapy. Then I move to another chair and I'm my therapist. And then I go back to the other chair and I'm myself in therapy again.
And literally staging or acting out pieces of your life.
Yes, I probably shouldn't talk about this in public. But
no, I find it fascinating. And again, a very creative way to deal with one's life.
I didn't used to do that. I used to just, you know, this habit very much evolved in tandem with the advent of digital photography. Mm. I used to have a Polaroid, but I had to use those very sparingly because it cost like a dollar a piece.
Yes.
But you can take endless digital photographs for nothing, and I do.
And you do, of yourself.
Yes.
In these various costumes. You also have a page here of, looks like some baby pictures of your mom when you're a little baby. You know, you look like one of those chubby little babies that we all know and, you know, love to hold. And it's looks like, as you say here, I don't have the negatives, so there's no way to know the chronological order, but I've arranged them according to your own narrative. And this is your mom, looks like, doing the, you know, the goo-goo ga-ga stuff that people do with babies.
Yeah, I was totally fascinated with those pictures. I didn't quite, I redrew those like five or six times, and I was never quite able to capture the real nuance of what was going on there. But the amazing thing about these photos is that my mother and I are exactly making the same faces. She's like opening her mouth or smiling, and I'm totally mimicking her. And this is in a section of the book where I'm talking about, Donald Winnicott describes the mother's face is a mirror, he says. What the mother's face looks like depends on what she is seeing. Is she really seeing the baby, or is she distracted? Is she looking at something else? And I love these pictures because my mother is absolutely looking at me. We were totally locked in on each other in this amazing sync. Mm. But then in the last picture, or what I choose to think of as the last picture, I'm looking away very suspiciously at the camera.
And it's your dad holding the camera.
Yes. Well, it might actually have been my uncle, but it was some guy. I think at 3 months, I don't know if babies, you know, in that era, I don't know if babies really could identify their fathers because fathers had so much less hands-on care of infants. But I'm looking at some guy.
With, as you say, a very worried look on your face. But you're right here, at 3 months, I had seen enough of my father's rages to be wary of him.
Yes. Yeah. I know that my father was always very angry and kind of violent, and I'm sure that I had seen a good deal of that by the time I was 3 months.
It's scary.
Yeah.
It's a scary household. I mean, to have a raging parent is really scary.
Yeah.
Let me get Noah called us up near the top of the hour. We have Noah from Pennington, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And Noah, hi, go ahead.
Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Hi. Fascinating conversation. I hate to distract, but I just needed to say that I'm a real big fan of applying the Bechdel test to movies.
Oh, yeah.
For those in the audience who don't know, next time you're watching a movie, think about whether or not there are two women that have a conversation in the film with each other, not about men. And you'll be surprised at just how many movies fail this test.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that and also what it's like to have something named after you like that.
Or who named who, I guess.
Well, I have very ambivalent feelings about the Bechdel test. I don't know how it got named after me. I wrote this cartoon 25 years ago, about what you just described, some women trying to find a movie to go to and they can't find one that meets those criteria. But somewhere along the line, it became called the Bechdel test. And I've since learned that there's something called Stigler's Law of Eponymy, which means that any scientific law is never named after the person who actually thought of it, but after someone else who somehow is loosely associated. And in fact, Stigler did not even invent Stigler's Law of Eponymy.
Oh, that's great. That's
but
great.
I stole that idea from a friend of mine, and now it's attached to me. But I'm very happy to claim it. It's a wonderful standard to apply to movies.
And it's probably a short list of movies, too, isn't it?
Well, it's getting longer.
Is it?
It was very short in 1985 when I wrote it. I think the only movie that fit the criteria was Alien, because the two women talked to each other about the monster. But I think the landscape is really changing, especially recently, with stuff like Lena Dunham's Girls series on HBO. Oh. That is just amazing, like real three-dimensional women characters. I'm very excited to see how stuff is changing.
Have you been basically cartooning your whole life? Did you cartoon as a kid, draw cartoons?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to be a cartoonist or a psychiatrist as a child.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And you sort of managed to include a lot of that in this book here.
Worked that both into this book, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And cartoon? Did you draw, the typical things a kid drew as cartoons of cartoons, for instance?
I drew cartoons. I mostly just was fascinated with figures. My dad would always try and encourage me to draw more backgrounds, but I wasn't interested in backgrounds. I would just draw figures, mostly men, like guys doing things that were exciting to me, like lumberjacks and firemen. And
wow.
Yeah, it took me a long time, actually, I had to sort of teach myself to draw women, and that came much later in life.
And this syndicated comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For, ran for something like 25 years?
Yeah, I started doing that soon after I got out of college, and only recently, a couple years ago, ended the series. Mm. It was like a soap opera, a strip that was serialized every week. The plot would evolve a little further. Half soap opera, half op-ed cartoon, because I would often work in current events.
Mm-hmm. So you were just done with it? I mean, 25 years is a long run, but were you done with it?
You know, I had very ambivalent feelings about ending. I thought I was just going to take a break, and I didn't really bring the strip to any kind of resolution. I just sort of left off and said I was taking a sabbatical, but I don't think I'm going to continue it.
And that's Alison Bechdel, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about her new memoir. It's called Are You My Mother? And she subtitles it A Comic Drama. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I think I know the answer, just having spent the hour with you, but you also, besides being a cartoonist, you wanted to be a psychiatrist, because it sounds like you are so interested in how the psyche works.
I am. I think also as a child, I would read the cartoons in the New Yorker, and I'd always see those analyst cartoons, the generic setup of the guy on the couch and the guy in the chair with his pipe. And I thought that would be such a cool job to listen to people's problems. Right. I would be a terrible therapist. I wouldn't be interested in other people's problems. I'm only interested in my own. But
that might be true for a psychiatrist. I don't know. Maybe you just have to be a good actor.
But I am very interested in the psyche and what's happening in our unconscious, this, you know, this whole other realm of life and the kind of information, the useful information it can provide us.
You mentioned living with your girlfriend in Vermont, and there was a New Yorker profile about you. And one of the lines from it, which I found really interesting, which is that you like to be alone, but you like to have someone else around,
I
think a lot of people can relate to that.
I'm always struggling with that balance. Solitude is very, very important to me, but God, I don't want to be completely alone at all. And I do live in the woods, which is a very nice, quiet life.
Yeah.
But my girlfriend wishes we were living in town. That's sort of an ongoing conversation.
Where there are, what, places to go out to eat and movies and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, all that, you know, friends, that sort of thing.
So the solitude for you, what, does it allow you to work? It allows you to draw, to take walks in the woods?
I love taking walks in the woods. I find that so restorative. I mean, yeah, it's time to write and draw without distraction, but I can just walk right out my door and I'm in a brook or on a trail, and I really, really love that.
Yeah, but here you are on a book tour, you know, having to...
Oh my God.
Have a very loud and public life.
I know. I was just reading an essay by that woman who wrote the book Quiet that just came out,
yes.
The book about the introverts. And she wrote a very interesting essay in the New York Times Book Review about the irony of being an introvert on a book tour, which I completely identified with.
Well, thank you for putting up with us for the hour. And Alison Bechdel, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so
thank
much
you, Marty.
For joining us today on Radio Times. And again, her book is Are You My Mother? A Comic Drama. She is a cartoonist. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.